The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
And then let me send around, I mentioned that I would be doing this, the synopsis of the book I've been working on, which is biographical profiles of many of the Westminster Divines, and then other Puritans the publisher wanted me to include. Since we're talking about these people, this will help you see what I've been working on. And I'll bring out some of the features of these people as we continue on the Westminster Assembly. I'd like to complete this material, but then also have some time for discussion. In fact, maybe what I'll do is get through these remaining divisions within the Assembly and then open it up for an opportunity of discussion of the reading, because I don't want to get away from the reading, particularly in Pelican, let it go another week before we get into discussion of the Roman Catholic trend. So I want to give opportunity for that, and then we'll take up points 4 and 5 as time allows. But as we get back into the figures of the Westminster Assembly, I had just described the Presbyterian ones. And this book I've been working on, see, one of the ironies about the Westminster Assembly is that the here you have the documents of Presbyterianism produced, the Westminster Confession of Faith and Catechisms, larger and shorter, a form of government, a directory for worship, all of which become standards for the Scottish Church. And then in Presbyterianism here in America and wherever Presbyterianism has gone. And the people who work on it, you do have this delegation of a half a dozen Scots who come down into England as a result of the Solemn League and Covenant of 1643, four of whom play a very active role. Well, one of the ruling elders does too, Archibald Johnston, Lord Warriston. But it's basically the major work is done by these English Puritans. In that synopsis I sent around, the ones who are in chapters 2, 7, and 8, I guess they are, and 9, 6, 7, and 8, I can't remember now the order. Anyway, the officers of the assembly, and then the ones listed as notable preachers and theologians or scholars and London clergy. Those are mostly Presbyterian people whose names are not very well known. And the reason is that Presbyterianism never took hold in England. It has a very brief time when it is the established church form of Christianity in England. And then Cromwell favors the independents. And when the king is restored, you're back to episcopacy again. And Presbyterians are in the nonconformists and so on, and soon develop into Unitarians, actually, in England. So you get all this work done. One thing that illustrates it is an American friend of mine visited Westminster Abbey a few years back and took the guided tour. And after he'd been shown around for a while in a group, he said, may we see the Jerusalem Chamber, please? And the tour guide said, well, why do you want to see that? And he said, because that's where the Westminster Assembly met. And the tour guide said, well, what was that? And that's sort of an illustration of the 20th century English knowledge of Presbyterianism. And this thing was of no particular significance to Church of England types. Well, here is a famous picture you often see in books about the Westminster Assembly. Done in the 19th century. It's sort of a Victorian piece of art. And the artist must have been Congregationalist rather than Presbyterian, because this is the big independent moment in the Westminster Assembly. This is Philip Nye here, who's making his appeal for liberty of conscience. And here are the Scots lined up over here, reacting in horror to any such idea. And then various others, you can see people raising their hands. And one of the people, I think it was Jeremiah Whitaker, wanted Philip Nye expelled from the assembly for making such an appeal at this point. Now, this painting also includes a number of people who would not have been there. Here's Oliver Cromwell sitting here, who might have come as a member of Parliament, but I don't think we have any evidence that he did. He was busy out fighting battles most of the time if this was going on. Back in London, to be sure, from time to time. But then you have in the back here other famous Puritans that the publisher wanted me to include in my book, like Richard Baxter and John Owen, who were not members of the assembly. They were slightly younger. And John Milton, and he despised these people eventually. Some of them had been his friends earlier, and he had been an ally over against episcopacy with them. But then when he wrote his tracts on divorce, and they opposed those writings, sought to have them banned, actually, he made some very nasty, beautiful poetry, but nasty sentiments against the Presbyterians. New presbyter is but old priest writ large. That's Milton. So a few people get in here who are not supposed to be in there. And then there are some rather significant ones that this artist left out. There is a thing on the back here which identifies all these people, so that you can figure it out. But I've been to the Jerusalem chamber, and that gives you some sense of the size of the room in which they met, connected with Westminster Abbey in London, and about 60 to 80 people on the average being there. And I don't know how many they've included here. Obviously, they're numbered. 71 are here, so just about the average amount. And that room is not a large room. That's about how crowded it would have been to have all those people gathered in the place. Well, you may want to take a closer look when you have time. And it hangs in my office if you don't get a chance today. Well, we had described some of the main Presbyterians last time, yesterday. And after having described the Episcopalians who had influence, and then the next group that I want to describe is the Independents, who sometimes got referred to as the five dissenting brethren, because they were objecting. As I mentioned, the main debates at the Westminster Assembly were not over doctrine. All of these people were good Calvinists. They agreed with the conclusions of the Synod of Dort. They had nuanced differences on the role of the passive obedience and the active obedience of Christ in connection with justification. That was one area where there was some debate. But by and large, they were all in agreement on certainly soteriology. And so church government or polity is where they had the main differences. And several of these independents, of whom the most famous is Thomas Goodwin, who made more speeches than anybody else and longer speeches. Philip Nye was kind of the manager of the Independent Party, kind of operating behind the scenes and pulling strings. He was really a politician. And then Jeremiah Burroughs is one of the most moderate of the independents. Banner of Truth has published some of his works, devotional works, and they're very, very good. And he was one who came closer to achieving reconciliation with the others. And William Bridge, likewise, a man, some of whose writings have been reprinted in recent years, is valuable devotionally. Sid Drack Simpson, there should be an R in there after the D, was the fifth one who wasn't as prominent as the others. These men had all been in exile in the days of Archbishop Laud, had been forced out of England, had gone to the Netherlands, and there had developed, in the context of the Reformed Church of the Netherlands, a congregational type of autonomy of church government, and had put it into practice to a certain extent. They had to relate to the classes, the what would correspond to the presbytery in Presbyterian terms, in the Netherlands there. So they weren't entirely autonomous, but being English, they were distinct in language and other things, and so they operated, tended to operate in a congregational or independent fashion. Now, they actually formed several churches in some of the different Dutch cities and had some association. Part of their argument was, we're not entirely different from Presbyterianism, but the degree of control is the difference. The local church should really be self-governing, and we resort to the higher level, or the broader level would be better, only if there's a need. It's not that the broader regional church would come in and control or dictate to the local church. So that was their emphasis, and they brought that back to England then after the Long Parliament came into position in 1640 and established, gathered churches in places like London and other cities, that is, churches of visible saints, people who made a clear profession of faith. They still held to infant baptism. They also held to a national church. They didn't want a disestablishment. They wanted a national church, but they wanted it to include these gathered congregations. And sometimes they met right in the same building with a Church of England, which would be a parish-type concept, and some other Puritan would be conducting worship there, and then there'd be this group gathered group meeting maybe Sunday afternoon or whatever in the same location. So it was confusing. The Scots, I'll describe them more in a moment, who came down sought to have an accommodation. They were even willing to have certain churches within the larger church, but have it not be a blanket toleration. There would have to be certain commitments by such people, but it was an impasse. They never were able quite to achieve a common agreement, and probably because both sides were insisting on church government by divine right, either Presbyterianism on the one hand, or what would become known soon after as Congregationalism on the other hand, that these either one or the other is the scriptural, the New Testament form of polity. And by both of them feeling the thing was determined by principle, you could never have any real compromise. So that's the tragedy, really, of the Westminster Assembly, that these good Puritan people on both sides couldn't work this out. I'll mention this, we'll say much more about the American Puritans in a subsequent lecture, the very next one, but the one of the things I had not realized so much before getting into this research for this book is there were three American Puritans invited to be members of the Westminster Assembly. I had known that, but I hadn't realized how influential they had been while they were still in England, before they came over here to America, namely John Cotton and Thomas Hooker and John Davenport. James Davenport was John. Anyway, they were invited to become members of the assembly, but could not manage to come. Roger Williams did come over and was an embarrassment to the independents because, while congregational himself in polity, he had made such a problem for the established congregationalism in Massachusetts Bay that he had fought against them, fighting for toleration there. So when he came over to England and wrote his Bloody Tenet of Persecution and so on, it was kind of a difficult thing for Goodwin and Nye and the other independents to explain, because here he was reacting against the Congregationalism of John Cotton and others in Massachusetts Bay because it was not tolerant. So here were the ones in England fighting for toleration, and their own colleagues in America were not giving toleration. So that's another part of the American connection. The Erastians were those who followed the views of Thomas Erastus, who was a theologian and medical doctor, actually, who was in the context of Zurich in Switzerland, then ended up in Heidelberg, but a reformed man who, however, insisted, sort of the way Zwingli had, that the civil government would be dominant with regard to church matters. So the church discipline would be carried out only with the agreement of the civil authority. That's what gets known as Erastianism, that role of the civil government. And you have three rather important Erastians as members of the Westminster Assembly. Thomas Coleman was a divine who was known for his Old Testament knowledge, as well as several others of the Westminster divines. But he was apparently a Hebrew expert, sometimes got called Rabbi Coleman, and made a very controversial speech at one point in the Erastian direction. John Lightfoot is a more moderate Erastian, great Old Testament scholar, whose reputation was already established by the time of the assembly, but became much greater later on as he published many, many works, some of which are still used by Old Testament scholars today. And he was Erastian in sentiment. He was one of the people who was very active in examining candidates for ministry. That was one of the time-consuming tasks for the Westminster Assembly. And then John Selden was a layman, a member of Parliament, who was one of the lay appointees, who was with Archbishop Usher and who else? Thomas Gadicker, William Twiss, was one of the best-known scholars of the day, a classical scholar, also learned in rabbinical lore. So intertestamental material and Talmudic material, which would be at earliest probably the same time as New Testament, but mostly produced after that. So these people, like many in the House of Commons, in Parliament, were Erastian in sentiment, and Selden made many of the key arguments in that direction. And the key was, will Christ be able to govern, as Calvin would have put it, in his own church through his appointed officers, namely elders and ministers? And there was what's called the crisis of the assembly, was when that issue came up between the assembly and Parliament. And they had to settle. In fact, in a way, it was never settled, because the parts of the Westminster Confession that went against Erastianism, describing the role of the civil magistrate, were never approved by Parliament. Those couple of chapters that relate to that, they got approved in Scotland, but not in England. So Erastianism, while there are very few in the assembly itself, Erastianism is an important aspect of the Westminster Assembly. Then the Scots I want to describe a little bit more, and then we'll give opportunity for questions on the reading. The Scots, of course, were Presbyterian, and thus agreed with the majority of the English Puritans in the assembly, but came with the experience of some generations since the time of Knox, of Presbyterianism having been practiced in Scotland. And the leader of this delegation was Alexander Henderson. I came to new appreciation of Alexander Henderson through my research for this book. Clearly the leader of those who established the National Covenant of 1638, who were willing, they signed it in blood, they were willing to take a stand very courageously for the truths of the Reformation that they felt had been established in Scotland over against the direction that Charles I and Laud were going. And he defied the king's representative, who tried to dismiss the General Assembly of Glasgow in 1638 and held them there as moderator and said, we're going to go on with our business, and took a stand to establish the covenant. And he dies before the assembly is over, actually back in Scotland, where the king is by that time, trying to negotiate with him and settling things in the direction of Presbyterianism. Samuel Rutherford is another one of the famous members of the assembly, is a Scottish delegate. He wrote the book Lex Rex, to which Francis Schaeffer made many references. Could be translated, The Law is King, or The Law and the King. It's on civil and religious liberty. It was written during the Westminster Assembly. And he was summoned to be tried and executed after the Restoration, but gave his famous answer, I must answer a higher summons. He was on his deathbed by that time and died before he could be tried and executed by Charles II. And Rutherford's an interesting personality. Scholars who've written on him say they can't imagine two more diverse types of literature than Rutherford's Lex Rex on the one hand and his letters on the other hand. His letters are, they're collected, Banner of Truth has published a whole volume of them, and I'll use a hymn in a few times on probably, that's based on one of his final letters written by a woman in the 19th century called The Sands of Time Are Sinking. But a lot of his, it's almost like Bernard of Clairvaux. He's been compared to Bernard of Clairvaux. A lot of his letters are very emotional, almost embarrassing so in describing his love for the Lord. And yet Lex Rex is a very scholastic production. John Marshall, who works in our development office, did his dissertation on Rutherford and had to wade through Lex Rex and many other writings like it. And he said, this is very difficult stuff to try to read. It's very technical. And Rutherford got an international reputation as a scholar also. Robert Bailey is one of our major sources on the knowledge of the assembly and what went on there, as his letters and journals describe some of the daily activities. The other ones are Lightfoot, who also wrote journals, accounts of certain parts of the assembly, not the whole thing. And George Gillespie, whom I'll describe in just a moment, who gave us some notes on the assembly. Those are our main sources. Thomas Goodwin apparently wrote notes on the assembly that have never been found, never been unearthed. They'd be very interesting coming from the independent side of the fence to see if he perceived things the same way. The other major source is the minutes. And they have been published after man in the early part of the century expended great effort to decipher the handwriting of some of the scribes. It's very difficult to read. I've looked, we have it on microfiche or film in the library. I've read some of it, but I'm sure Dr. Ferguson's worked with it more, but the minutes are not very satisfactory. In some instances, they're very full. In others, they're very sketchy. And so you don't always get a lot of information as to what really went on. But Bailey is very helpful, and he played the role among the Scots that Philip Nye played among the Independents. He never made a speech on the floor the entire time, but was doing a lot of caucusing and smoke-filled room type activity and behind closed doors negotiating. He has records one time where they realize they're reaching an impasse with the independents, and he said, so some of us decided we would invite Brother Goodman to have dinner with us and talk these things over. So they did a lot of that sort of negotiating. And then George Gillespie, notice his dates, 1613 to 48, he's sometimes referred to as the youngest member of the assembly. I found really younger, a few months younger, who didn't play. Work is finished. and goes back and is moderator of the General Assembly in Scotland, and dies of consumption, apparently. What they called consumption would be tuberculosis. One of the most brilliant members of the Assembly, and I even though this is an apocryphal story, I want to share it with you as illustrative of the quality of this Assembly, the kind of people, and the caliber of discussion that went on. And there is some possibility it was true. But the story is that when the Assembly was debating that part of the Shorter Catechism as to how to answer the question, what is God? Well, you know, how are you going to say that in language that in the Shorter Catechism was intended for children and young people in the faith and so on? And they weren't getting anywhere, apparently, in coming up with the wording for this. So then they called on George Gillespie to lead in prayer. And the story goes that he started out, O God, thou who art a spirit, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in thy being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, and truth. And we don't know if they said, stop, George, you got it, in the middle of his prayer, or wrote it down after he'd finished. But that's the story. Now, typical scientific historians of the turn of the century have said that couldn't have happened because when the catechism was debated, the Scots had already gone back to Scotland, which is true. However, there was a lot of committee work that went on prior to its coming to the floor, and this thing could have happened in the committee. I like to think it was true. The way the assembly operated was that it set aside one entire day each month for prayer and fasting and preaching. This was by an act of Parliament, actually, that Parliament would dismiss its members from the normal business, and once a month, I think it was the fourth Wednesday, typically, I can't remember now the exact day they chose, but it was something like that, that they would always gather. And when they had these days of fasting in Puritan circles, this was an all-day proposition. They usually had two members of the assembly to preach, and typically the sermon would last an hour and a half to 2 hours, at least 1 hour. And then they'd have prayer before, in the middle, and at the end of the two sermons, and these prayers would go 2 hours in length. The prayers typically were longer than the sermons, according to those who wrote down what happened. And particular people were assigned to offer the prayer as well as to preach on that day. So obviously what they did was prepare very thoroughly what that prayer would be, even though you have debates later between Owen and Baxter as to whether prayer in a worship service should ever be written out. Owen thought that was wrong. That was a stinted worship, is what they called it. Baxter believed that liturgy was appropriate, and so you could have written prayers. But obviously these people, if they're going to pray for 2 hours, must have at least prepared a rough outline of what they wanted to say to God. And then the picture you should have is they're just pouring themselves out, pouring out their hearts to the Lord. Steve? Yeah, yeah. Hard to believe, isn't it, from our point of view. But really, you know, we can imagine a sermon going on that long. Some of us have experienced hour-long sermons, I imagine. I have. Haven't preached any that long. But I don't know whether people all closed their eyes in those days when they prayed or not. Not necessarily. But it'd be easy to fall asleep if you did. But I think these people were very animated in their preaching, and I suspect they were in their prayers likewise. And that kept everybody awake and lively. But they simply were talking to God rather than talking to the people around them as they would be in preaching. Among the eight rules of procedure that were set down by Parliament, remember these people in Parliament are basically Puritan laymen. They're mostly committed Christians. One of them was, what any man undertakes to prove as necessary, he shall make good out of Scripture. The oath of membership included this part: I will maintain nothing in point of doctrine but what I believe to be most agreeable to the Word of God, nor in point of discipline but what may make most for God's glory and the peace and good of His church. One more thing about to illustrate the caliber of the assembly, and then we'll open it up for questions from the reading. The major crisis, as I mentioned, had to do with Erastianism. And here's an account of Gillespie's response to Samuel Rutherford. I'm reading from J.D. Douglas's work called Light in the North, which is about the Scottish Covenanters. He takes time to tell this about Gillespie. During the debate on church discipline, the Presbyterians found themselves opposed by the two other parties, the Independents and the Erastians. The former, who held what was adjudged to be the untenable position that the church had no power of excommunication, soon retired from the debating floor on this particular issue. The Erastians, though admitting such a power, placed it in the hands of the civil authority. One of their leaders, the learned Selden, held forth at great length with a staggering display of minute rabbinical lore, striving to demonstrate that Matthew 18, 15 to 17, the passage under dispute, contained no warrant for ecclesiastical jurisdiction, but concerned the ordinary practice of the Jews in their common civil courts. Even the most erudite and able of the divines present were in no hurry to encounter such a formidable opponent. Samuel Rutherford, the story goes, turned to Gillespie and said, and I wish I had Dr. Ferguson's Scottish brogue here, "Rise, George, rise up, man, and defend the right of the Lord Jesus Christ to govern by his own laws the church which he hath purchased with his blood." With every appearance of reluctance, Gillespie rose, gave first a summary of the previous speech, stripping it of all its cumbrous learning and reducing it to simple language. Then steadily, point by point, he completely refuted it, proving that the passage in question could not be interpreted or explained away to mean a mere reference to a civil court, and that the Jews both possessed and exercised the right of spiritual censures. The effect of Gillespie's speech was so great as not only to convince the assembly, but also to astonish and confound Selden himself, to whom Gillespie was a veritable enfant terrible. The Erastian leader is reported to have exclaimed in bitter mortification, "That young man, by this single speech, has swept away the learning and the labor of 10 years of my life." Well, the biographer of Gillespie, even in the Dictionary of National Biography, says that that can't be true. Selden would never have said something like that. And it is questionable. I don't know what the evidence is, really. Douglas doesn't. He cites another secondary source, and I've looked in there, and it's hard to track it down as to what proof there is for that particular story, but it's another good story. It is clear that Gillespie, what is clear is that he did answer Selden's arguments, and one or two others also responded very ably, and Selden didn't try to counter. So the arguments were strong. Well, we've got 15 minutes or so, and I want to give some opportunity before I conclude this to answer questions you may have out of the reading. McNeil's dealing with some of the same stuff, but particularly in Pelican, if you have questions relating to the Roman Catholic developments this time, this is the chance to either comment on it or raise some questions. I could think of some good final exam questions. Well, a couple of interesting things, I think, that you do see here. He makes reference to the Council of Regensburg and the discussion of justification there, where Cardinal Contarini was ready to agree with Bucer and the others about justification by faith alone, that it was proper to use that language as long as it was understood that one's life was affected, that love also pursued. But then the Pope and the Vatican didn't buy that, the Curia, so that didn't fly, and nor could the other Protestant leaders readily agree that the Catholics really meant the same thing that they did. I think the other interesting figure in this account is Serapando, one of the Augustinians active at the Council of Trent. On 275, you'll notice the purposes of the Council of Trent, called in 1542, so it's just the year after Regensburg. You have Paul III having come in as Pope, who's much more adamant now in the direction of being anti-Protestant. But here are the purposes: to meet the Protestant reformers on their own grounds, so to take up their own tenets, like all the solas, sola fide in regard to justification, sola gratia, and then sola scriptura, and so on, to harmonize contradictions within the patristic and medieval traditions. So there's recognition that in the tradition there wasn't uniformity, and they had to try and explain that, to harmonize them. And third, to resolve the differences among the defenders of the Roman Catholic faith themselves. So what you have then is out of, we didn't read the first part of Pellican's volume 4 in this course. He goes back to 1300 to show the amount of pluralism that existed in the late medieval church coming into the Reformation era. And now the Council of Trent pulls together a new uniformity for Roman Catholicism over against Protestantism. So that's an important thing to be able to discuss, the Council of Trent. Then on 281, he comments about Serapando and the discussion of justification. No other decree of this council, and few decrees of any council before or since, received such meticulous care. So a very careful discussion. On 285, there is some interesting material. Well, here's where the reference is to Regensburg. At Regensburg in 1541, under Gropper's leadership, Protestant and Roman Catholic spokesmen had been able to agree that the formula of speaking, it's in quotes, of the reformers, that we are justified by faith alone, was not unacceptable, but only with the understanding that, quote, it is the firm and sound doctrine that the sinner is justified through a faith that is living and active. Well, we would agree with that. And then they, at Trent, they got into a discussion of the four traditional Aristotelian causes, and Serapando makes an interesting comment on that. He reminded his colleagues that neither the scriptures nor the ancient fathers of the Catholic Church had so much as mentioned this system of causes, and that it was philosophy that creates these difficulties for us when we seek to talk about divine mysteries on the basis of its rules. So that it shows there was a segment of the Council of Trent that really was trying hard to be scriptural and not just be governed by scholastic philosophy, and try hard to learn from the Protestant Reformation to make some adjustments. By and large, the Council of Trent did not do that and ended up anathematizing the cardinal doctrines of the Protestant Reformation. While the trends in the Catholic Church today are much more positive and accommodating in many respects, they've never repudiated these anathemas in the Council of Trent in any official way, to my knowledge. So those things are still of issue. Other questions or comments anybody wants to raise on out of the reading? Do try to do the reading before the end of the semester. Okay. Well, let's go back to the Westminster Assembly. To talk about the Assembly's accomplishments. Through committees, Several tasks were being tackled at once. A Presbyterian form of church government was adopted, thanks largely to Gillespie's defeat of the Erastians and of the Independents in debate. The debate with the Independents extended over a two-year period. It lasted into 1645. And finally, they were asked to bring in their own form of church government with its scriptural theological base, because they'd just been fighting anything the Presbyterians presented. The Presbyterians were trying hard not to present it. Both sides were really trying to maintain a unity and avoid the divine right argument. And so the Presbyterians had tried hard not to make it an issue of divine right. And the Independents kept resisting. And finally, in frustration, the motion was made, well, will the five dissenting brethren go apart and prepare their own answer and bring it in? The Independents felt, they weren't given enough time to do it. They ended up producing a document after they'd, in effect, departed from the assembly. But again, it was one of the tragedies that they could not work this out in a viable way. So the Presbyterian form of church government was adopted by the assembly, was presented to the Parliament in November of 1644, but not put into effect immediately. Cromwell was seeking toleration for the Independents and the sects. And meanwhile, a directory of public worship was adopted by the assembly in December of 44, then by the Parliament in January of 45. This was one of the most urgent things, because and by the Scottish Parliament in February of 1645. This was the most urgent thing because they needed to get the weekly, even daily worship that went on in the churches established, some uniform way. They had agreed that the old form, the Book of Common Prayer, was no longer to be used. So what are people going to do? And so they had no doubt had some interim expedients, but they needed to get something that was established and also to have something for ordaining candidates for the ministry. The great Puritan urge was, you know, the impetus was get preachers out into the corners of the realm so the scriptures can be shared. So this Directory of Public Worship was a very important step. The assembly as a whole discussed the Confession of Faith from July 1645 to December 1646. So about a year and a half went into the passage of the confession itself. So careful discussion of almost phrase by phrase of what was adopted in the Confession of Faith. The so-called crisis of the assembly occurred in the spring of 1646 over the Erastian and parliamentary desire for the prerogative of determining who could or could not take the Lord's Supper. What had happened by this time was that they wanted to have some kind of definition of what sins are scandalous enough that there has to be some kind of discipline exercised. And then who's going to do it, you see? And Parliament actually took steps to set up certain commissions of Parliament in the different shires or counties of the realm to administer this discipline. And the assembly reacted, said this isn't right that the civil government take responsibility for that. This is a function of the church. And that's what caused the breach, the crisis of the assembly. And they were accused of standing up to Parliament, so breach of proper procedure. And three of the members of Parliament came and kind of dressed down the assembly at that point. The assembly took it very well. They didn't respond in kind, waited calmly after the members of Parliament had left and decided on the next day what procedure they would follow. And meanwhile, they just kind of bit their tongues. They didn't respond. Lord Archibald Johnston of Warriston of the Scottish delegation made a notable speech on that occasion stressing the rights of King Jesus in his own kingdom. And that was to the assembly. These ruling elders who came, by the way, in my book, there are just a few of them that are included. Johnson of Warriston is one, and the other one is John Maitland, who becomes the Earl of Lauderdale, who was only 25 years old when he came down for the assembly. And he ends up becoming a close friend of Charles II. It's said that he was the only Scotsman Charles ever liked, and actually governs Scotland during the time of Charles II, the Restoration, and persecutes the Covenanters. So he's a complete turncoat. Now, Richard Baxter and Robert Bailey both appealed to him, to his conscience, and he became very worldly and so on. But Johnson of Warriston is a very notable character as a ruling elder, led family devotions that included prayers at the dinner table that went an hour long. We have his diary. He apparently was kind of a, maybe a manic depressive would be the way to describe him. But he had some psychological struggles. One reason he didn't go into the ministry, he recognized that he didn't have an even enough temperament to do that. But he was finally put to death by Charles II after the Restoration. But these ruling elders are interesting. Sir Henry Vane, who had actually been governor of Massachusetts, again in his 20s, came back to England, was a member of Parliament, member of the Assembly, played an important role, later closely associated with Oliver Cromwell. So these are fascinating characters that are involved. Well, to continue the story of the documents that were produced, the Parliament required scripture proofs for the different, particularly the confession and the catechisms. That took until April of 1647 to provide the scripture proofs for the confession. And meanwhile, Presbyterian church government had gone into effect in June of 1646. So England was officially Presbyterian for about 2 years, but it, in fact, was not implemented uniformly. In London, the London clergy were strongly Puritan. You did get a Presbyterian establishment there for pretty solidly established, and in a few other places like Lancashire, far to the northwest, but not many across the realm. The larger catechism was debated for 1 year after committee work of 2 years, see how thorough the work is, and was sent to Parliament in October 1647, and the shorter catechism was finished in November of 1647. So you can see we can still celebrate the 350th anniversary of these documents down to 1997. Parliament approved the confession in June of 1648 and the catechisms with proofs in September of 1648. By early 1648, most of the work of the assembly was done, with many of the leaders now dead. The Scottish commissioners had left by the end of 1647 after the larger catechism was completed. So the shorter catechism, which is probably the most influential document of all, does not reflect the work of the Scots so much, interestingly. The assembly led a nominal existence down till March of 1652 as mainly a committee for examining candidates for the ministry. By this time, Oliver Cromwell was completely in charge down until his death in 1658. The Restoration in 1660, first of Parliament, then of the monarchy, and then of the Episcopal Church, brought reversal and persecution of Presbyterians and nonconformists of all sorts in 1662, again on St. Bartholomew's Day in August. Some 2,000, the estimates range higher than that too, but at least 2,000 ministers ejected from their pulpits. But the Westminster Standards lived on in Scotland after 1688, when the Glorious Revolution took place, to be adopted by Presbyterians in America in 1729 and afresh in 1787, with modification of the confession on the civil magistrate. We'll come back next week to give a summary of the Puritan distinctives and entertain any discussion of these matters at that time. And you'll be reading the confession and the catechisms. Probably most of you have had occasion to read them before, but maybe never in one sitting. I think you'll you'll come to appreciate if you can read the confession through in one sitting. And maybe you haven't read the larger catechism before. You'll find some real value in that. We'll talk more about that.